Hello, 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 everyone. Welcome back to How Do You Jew, the podcast that highlights the diversity of the Jewish experience so that we can increase Achdut Israel and we can finally get Geula already. I have with me today quite a fantastic, interesting Jew. She is absolutely one of a kind. I met her first here living locally in Northeast Ohio as she was wandering around the neighborhood, enjoying the natural world on Shabbat, really just diving into the lovely energy of the day and how beautiful the trees were with her kids. And I invited them in for tea and we ended up diving headfirst into everything from holistic medicine to agriculture to homeopathy to astrology to the Renaissance Festival and beyond. She is a woman of She is a woman of many talents and is fully, completely, 100% committed to her Jewish experience in her own way. She's a licensed massage therapist. She's also an engineer. She's also a brilliant agricultural specialist and more. I can't wait for you guys to meet her. This is an amazing Jew. Welcome to How Do You Jew, Amit Shuk.
Hello.
Hello. So first and foremost, your handle on Zoom says imitating Eden. So this kind of leads to my first question. Can you tell us a little about yourself, where you're from, what you do, and how your Jewish identity shapes your life?
Yeah, so I'm from Southern California. I grew up sort of adjacent to Chabad, with going to Chabad Hebrew school, after school, and shul, and slowly my family became more religious over time, more observant. So that was early life. And when I went away to college, I kind of went exploring spirituality, and afterwards I stepped more into, I wanted deep diving into the Orthodox experience and Gemara and Tanakh and all that stuff.
Okay. All right. Sounds familiar. Keep going.
And then, you know, over time you get all that stuff and then you have to figure out how that works in your life. So mostly I think I figure that out. But it's always developing as we develop as a people.
Amazing. So in terms of what do you do now, what do you do for a living, for Parnassa, and how is it influenced by your Jewish identity?
So I do urban permaculture. So one of the things I also learned more of when I was in college is like the professor said, this isn't going to affect us because we're old, but in you and your children's lifetime, based on population growth curves, resource models, etc. I'm looking, there's a rodent out over there. It's probably a vole trying to burrow in the ground. Anyway, we're going to experience some changes, and that could be negative or positive, but we should prepare ourselves for some major changes in our lifetime. And so with that, I was in school for being an electrical engineer, and I decided that and also a trip to Israel where I was in going around the archaeology there, that I wanted to switch to something else that would be more useful to the future. And so I ended up working for the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service after college, where I was helping agriculture become more sustainable, work within our resource means. And that more and more reaffirmed that we need to be able to do that, live, you know, within our resource means. And so one of the things I recognized was that's easier to do on a countryside, but in the city where most people live, that's really challenging. So I decided when moving to Cleveland that I was going to make a project to see how sustainable one can be in suburbia, where we can have our communities close together, but we can also have that sustainability, that ability to live within our resource means.
I love that.
And I have gotten really far. Permaculture is basically rebuilding Don Eden. So
Yes.
you are building an ecosystem which supports itself so that you actually do very minimum work of destruction, like the weeding and hoeing and holes and like tilling, all that stuff. You don't do that. You basically help the earth cycle in a healthy direction. And most of what I do is harvest. It's just harvest, harvest, harvest. And
You have a
it's
lot to
amazing.
harvest right now, too. Your
Oh,
stuff
my
is
goodness.
exploding.
Yes. It's wonderful.
For those of you who don't know, Amit is a very good friend of mine, and I hang out with her, and we go hang out at her. I haven't been since summer has exploded in her garden. She has what she calls an urban food forest. You can walk around her property and pick food. It's amazing.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right. And right now it's just all 100% green because we're using basically every ounce of solar energy during summer to produce food and fiber now. Basket weaving is, and I've used some of it like for cooking and all these other things. So more resources every year. And then we also put away for winter in freezers or canning or drying so that all year where some portion of our diet comes directly from the land.
Amazing. So I want to, I mean, I have a list of questions I always ask everyone, but I also want to dive headfirst in this because sustainability is one of my most favorite topics of conversation. And you and I have talked about the fact that most observant Jews don't get it, and they're not involved in participating in their food cycle. So, in terms of sustainability and conserving resources, could you break that down for maybe those Jews that are the tinfoil plastic plate almost every day kind of Jews? Like, what does it mean to live with your resources? What does it mean to be an urban food forest, or to live with, live sustainably? What does that mean in baby talk, in base language?
So I got into I started reading the five books, the first one, Bereishis, and I got to about the first chapter where it said, you should take care of the earth, and went, oh, and ran outside and didn't come back because we failed
Nice.
so miserably at that.
Actually, that's one of the first commandments, by the way.
Absolutely. It basically that was when, yeah. First creation. This is the one job you got.
You have a
That's so.
job. It's extremely important. Please do it.
And so that's basically that one job in the first, chapter of the book is what it. But I also there's so much after that though. When you
Yes.
go into Kolayim and you go into, you. Just the holidays, they're all based on the earth there in the Middle East. The celebrations of harvest. And there's so much discussion of even like what happens if the ants take your grain and move it to the other person's property? Like we're talking all about
Wait, like the ants on
agriculture.
the ground?
Yes. There's the
Are you
part of,
serious? They talk about that in
yes,
the Talmud?
absolutely.
Oh my,
Absolutely.
wow. They really do talk about everything.
Because in starvation, where like, okay, your crop's not doing well, but I can raid an ant hole and get some things.
Oh, that's true.
That's important, and that might be a life or death situation.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
And then even as you're, it also says if you're, Torah's for Earth, we are on
Yes.
Earth,
Yeah.
so. In Shemayim, you don't need to eat food and wear clothes and all that stuff. So here we are on Earth having these mitzvot to interact with it. You get a lot more mitzvot if you do than if you just focus on reading and not interacting. So, yeah, I mean, every time I walk through my grape orchard, and if I have the mitzvah like to pull out the weeds under where it's growing. So that's like daily, multiple.
So is it considered doing one mitzvah multiple times, or are they all new mitzvot?
That's a good one.
I am not a rabbi, so I have no clue.
Yeah. To ask somebody about that.
I think it's a very good question. Hey, buddy. Can you open this? Of course I can, boo boo. Say hi. So I love that. And so is that what you do for a living in terms of sustainable living and creating food forests and being a urban permaculture expert? Is that your parnassa?
So that's part of it. And then the other part is massage therapy. So,
I'm on a call. I'm interviewing my wonderful friend who you know, and I need to talk to her without any
is
interruptions.
she a meat?
Yes, she is Amit.
Hi.
Highest tree in the whole world. She didn't grow the highest tree in the whole world. I love you. I know. I love you. I love you. Go on. Go on. Okay.
Okay.
Oh, my
So,
lanta.
yeah.
Don't slam the door. Your sister's sleeping. So back again. So,
So my Parnassa is twofold. I have Imitating Eden, where I work on sustainability, and then I have massage. So in I see it as we are part of the earth. I mean, it says we are made of from the earth.
We are.
So it's healing the people is part of healing the world, and healing the world is part of healing the people. So I do both. And in the area we live, 6 8 months out of the year-ish, is growing things, and then the rest of the time is not. So, it's a good balance, that I get out of doing both. I do year-round, though, do Imitating Eden just to get people aware of sustainability, encouraging them to make the little changes. Even if we each person just did one little change, it makes a big difference over time. So the more people, and there's a lot of knowledge that's just not there, and it takes a long time to gain. So I try to share what I learn, and even the plant material that I have, because I've built it up over time. And some of it, the people who used to grow these plants, they retired. So unless we continue that, they're lost.
So I love that. And then you said you teach that in classes, I'm assuming, or do you do
Yeah.
private sessions? Like, how does that work?
So I teach that in classes. I also do private consultations, and then I also do social media as well.
And didn't you say that you've actually partnered with a farm and you've worked with some rabbeim to make sure that there is kosher shechting somewhere done once a year?
Oh, yes, we have that, like kosher as in not just the knife at the last minute, but how the animals were raised completely. So that, I mean, the idea of you are what you eat. If you're eating a traumatized, scared animal, what does that put in you? And they actually have shown that the hormones of the animal, those are in the meat, and that does get into you.
It
And
does.
that does affect your how your brain, your higher and lower brains function
I
together.
love that. So that's really you taking your Jewish identity and implementing it physically in this world on a day-to-day basis.
Oh yeah, I
Oh,
guess.
that's
Well,
amazing.
to me, Judaism is it's a way of life. It's not separate. It's every moment of every breath.
And you're physically embodying it, both like as a practice, but also as a digestive service and a digestive system and an interactive, you're walking through your food forest and you're this woman has brought lamb over that was shechted, that she knew the lamb. She made sure it was raised well. Like I've eaten the food that she's helped produce. It's been really incredible. And I could go on forever with this. She's also helping me with my backyard design because we're going to make it a sustainable backyard. And she's an expert, and I love that. But I am curious. We've had many conversations about this. Since you live your Judaism, embody your Judaism, walk the walk, and talk the talk, what is something that you wrestle with? And what is something that you love?
And to go back to that, well, actually, even the air you breathe is
Even the
affected
air.
because
Yes.
the plants are producing that. So,
Yes.
and we've shown that in forest, the certain the chemicals the plants, the trees produce affect your mental health as well and brain
Absolutely.
function. So,
Absolutely.
okay, but on to what I wrestle with.
Yes.
So my what I wrestle with the most is the lack of spiritual women leaders in Judaism. We have some really great ones from the time of the prophets, and then when we move into sort of the Roman and beyond with the male dominance, I would say the Christian philosophy, which is also very male dominant. We lose our women spiritual leaders. Where are the women prophets? Where are the Chassidische Rebbetzin that speak with those in heaven and the connection, have that connection to God? We're supposed to all have it, but we see it talked about in men, but as a woman, it would be nice to have those to look up to rather than, blazing our own paths.
I have lots of opinions about that.
I'm sure you do.
Oh my God, do I ever? It was one of the things that kept me away from Torah observant Judaism for a very long time. And I was really annoyed by the fact that the women that I knew were very intuitive and very empathic and really connected to Hashem in many, many unique ways. And that the rabbis that I knew, the rabbis I spoke to, were deeply disconnected. They were not practicing embodied spirituality at all. They were reciting intellectual information. And it was very frustrating. I completely relate to that desire to have powerful women spiritual leaders. And I mean, there's that argument that like we don't have Bat Kol anymore, we don't have Nevuah anymore, which is Hebrew for voice of prophecy and voice of spirituality. But I don't know, like, some of these rabbis across the world are being treated like almost like prophets. And almost like spiritual guides. So why aren't women in the same, echelon? It's a very good question.
Yeah, there is one of the rabbis locally who was very orthodox. He sent out weekly parsha, and one of the ones was him. The rabbi who spoke to the spirit of this rabbi and spoke to the spirit of that rabbi in some of his studies. And so, okay, and they also it also says in some Hasidic teachings that towards the end of this time period, that those would start coming back to the world.
Yeah, I've heard that as well.
So,
Yeah,
yeah.
it's frustrating. Now, that is something you wrestle with. What's something you love?
What I love is the when I read certain things in Judaism. The writings, especially in Tehillim, I hear like these very spiritual leaders from like I'm like getting all emotional from like way thousands of years ago,
Yeah.
reaching out to future generations and
Yeah.
say, I want to teach you. I want you to learn what I can't pass down directly
Yeah.
because I know they're going to come and destroy me and destroy all that I love. But this little ounce will pass down through the generations, and I'm waiting for that to flourish again, and I'll be there for it.
Oh
So.
yeah. We're gonna be dancing at the Beit HaMikdash together, you and me. Gotta buy new clothes for it. Clothes
Right. Handmade.
that
I've
fit. I
got, I
love
know
that.
some wool, local wool.
Yes, exactly. Made from local artisan, sustainable, artisanal wool. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that's one of the coolest things. I feel like sometimes like Tehillim and Tanakh in general, it's like a fractal. And the deeper you go, the deeper you go. And it seems like a bottomless place to, like it's a rabbit hole upon a rabbit hole. And you just look at something and then there's more layers and there's more messages. And depending on your age, there's more messages. And depending on your life circumstances, there's more messages. And I find myself sometimes asking, like, how did they know?
Right.
How did you know, Mr. Rabbi Hanina from 2,500 years ago, like that I was going to be stressed out about this thing in 2025? Like, how did they know? You know, it's wild. Yeah.
So.
So, yeah. Yeah, I love that. Wow. Amazing. So, now comes the big headliner question, because you are so unique in the way that you do things. I have to ask, Amit, how do you do? How do you bring your unique flavor of Judaism to the world and in your everyday life?
So there's, I mean, like there's at Yom Kippur, it's a there's the little story of like God going around saying, are you being the best you to the trees and the this and the like, are you being so, am I being me? What, how did God create me to be me? And that's actually something I struggle with is what makes a person a person versus that. I get, it's like to me, it's spirituality is an individual path, but my ancestors laid out this beautiful path called Judaism. And so it has so much wisdom and so much tradition and beauty. And so you do that in a way that it feels like what God made me as me, I guess. That makes it my unique way.
Is it like from that story of like Zusha, why weren't you more Zusha? Is it that one?
Right, like that type, there's other like, kid takes on it and like
Yeah.
children books, but yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And that was actually the message when I was meditating on Yom Kippur last year. It's like, okay, you're being you, but you need to be more you, and you need
Yeah.
to stand up and be you more rather than. And I think a lot of us Jews, from the traumas of being basically harassed because we're Jewish, we don't stand up and say, hey, this is, I'm being the best person I possibly can be. And this is me.
Yeah.
As my best understanding of what that is.
As soon as you said that, I heard the "This Is Me" from The Greatest Show in my head.
Great song.
And you're completely right. There's so many different layers of reasons behind why people are afraid to be themselves. I don't think, obviously there's not one answer. There's a lot of trauma, of being harassed, of the anti-Semitism, especially lately. But even just this idea that there's this level of conformity that we all have to fit into some sort of friggin' box. And it's one of the many reasons I chose you to come on this show, because you're like, box? What box? I turned it into something in my food garden. There's no box.
Yeah, well, it also says like one of the fruit eaten in the garden was one that said things were good or bad, which is boxing things versus okay, sort of the other instead of Gamzu Latova, this too is for the good, Nakamish Gamzu, and so, and this too is for the good, but it is also. I mean, that's a translation, but it is the good as well, because everything is God.
I agree with you. And I think it's a much needed perspective. Again, there's a lot of reasons I asked you to come on the show. One of them is that you demonstrate a really fantastic embodied version of courage that we don't always see in Torah observant Jews. One of the, and again, I'm saying this as a Baal Tshuva, I still feel like an outsider, like 8 years in, and I can look around the community that we live in and see all of these folks that are from birth. They were born and raised this way. This is just who they are. Their families have been Torah observant Jews for several generations, et cetera. And this is just normal for them. And part of that culture, sadly, is this ridiculous idea that you have to make yourself smaller and smaller and smaller and more humble and more humble and more humble and more humble and like not be yourself, like sacrifice the uniqueness of who you are for the sake of other people's comfort and for the sake of conformity and the sake of not rocking the boat. And it's all sort of on this like sacrificial altar of humility. And then people end up miserable, and then they end up living that Zusha story, like they get to heaven and God's like, why weren't you more you? And like you're like absolutely not that way. And I love that.
Thank you.
You're
Thank you.
welcome. You're
Yeah, I do
welcome.
not conform very well. Fear, I mean, it says, and the main, the song, and the main is to recall, I have no fear, no fear at all.
Yes.
Right? And the fear is lower brain function, and the higher brain functions are inhibited by fear. And that's more your the higher brain functions are your analytical, they're associated with the higher levels of the soul development. But there was a time when I was little. This is a funny story. I went to we used to sleep a Friday night we'd sleep over at my grandpa Safdan Saba's house. And Saba had a horror movie on the TV
Oh
or the
boy.
And I was little, and I happened to see the part of this movie where there was a crazy lady jumping out of doors and trying to kill people.
Oh,
And
fantastic.
so I was like, I'm not sleeping over. But then I went home, and in my room, there was a door to a closet.
Oh boy.
And I was petrified. But I was old enough to know that it's like not cool to go talk to your parents about that. So somewhere in my brain it said, okay, I'm gonna get up and go stand in the closet in the dark and say, okay, I'm here. I did it. If something was going to kill me, jump out at me, would have done it. And then I'm gonna go to sleep.
Wow, that is so much braver than I ever was.
Did that every night.
Oh my gosh.
And then at a certain point, when I was sad, I just need to cry. And I'm like, the farthest way, I want to cry in private, farthest way, place away from everyone in my family who I can cry in private was this closet. Went in the back of the closet and I started crying. And I cried to the point where I didn't have any more tears. And all of a sudden, I felt this immense love and like peace. And it became my meditation closet. And that's where I would go to talk to God after school and just like when I needed that. So, I mean, to me, that is like, that story is like facing, I think it's registered psychologically to me as facing your fears has immense benefits in connecting to God and having a sense of peace.
I'm going to repeat that back because that was you guys need to be writing this down, okay? Or like downloading this episode, okay? Because that was immense. So we said having courage and facing your fears has immense, how did you phrase it? Immense.
Expect me to repeat myself?
It has this spiritual payoff, is what you're saying.
Yes.
I love that.
Yeah.
Also, you're not the first woman, actually, who I've spoken to who was like younger-ish and then went into a private space, whether it was a closet or bedroom, whatever, and was crying, 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 and then was exhausted. And then all of a sudden, this flood feeling of warmth and love and care and being held overtook them. And they immediately knew it was Hashem.
Yeah, it's the honestly, I've heard other spiritual people interviewed the same thing. It's like something about that letting all that go and draining your entire amygdala is just like your connect.
Yeah. Well, and I know that, I mean, in terms of like physiology, there's a tremendous amount of those really stressful chemicals in the system that are released through tears, through the tear ducts. And I believe, if I remember correctly, they only come out through the tear ducts. So if we don't cry, they don't come out. And then when we do cry and they come out, then they're gone and we don't have to deal with them. And we can like allow that peace to come through,
Yeah.
which you
And
clearly figured out.
yes, and then I still practice that with a lot, meditation, but also with co-counseling, and even with my clients when in massage, there's something called an emotional release. And so when people getting massage, they have those memories come up. It's something that we as therapists encourage them to let out rather than holding on to so that they can have that peace.
I have personally experienced that. I know exactly what you're talking about. Because the body has memory and the cells have memory. And I mean, see, that's another example of stuff that I don't know that a lot of Torah observant Jews are cognizant of. And I mean, I think I've said it before, like one half of the audience that I speak to in this pod, all three of them in this podcast is, Torah observant Jews who might be a little extra judgy today and who are thinking that there's only one right way to Jew. And then I introduce them to amazing folks like you, and remind them that actually, no, we can Jew in many different ways. And the other half of the audience is folks that maybe have not stuck their toe in the pool of, keeping a mitzvah, and maybe hearing your story or my story or someone's story will inspire them to go, actually, you know what? Maybe I could do this. But I've noticed like a lot of Torah observant Jews are like not aware that like we have to be embodied in what we're doing. And the body knows this, and the muscles know this, and the organs know this, and the skin knows it. And like, it's not woo-woo. Like it used to be considered woo-woo, because we didn't have science to support it. And then suddenly we've developed biofeedback, and we've developed Reiki as a medicinal practice through the Cleveland Clinic. And like all of these, sciences are now catching up to what the spiritualists understood. And clearly you're living it, you're doing it every single day. And that's just, it's so fantastic.
And it feels really good when you get to be yourself and that energy flow when
Yes.
you get to be yourself. Because that, that's what God made you for. If you're not going to do your job, I think Esther was told this when she was told to go to front of the king, is basically like, sure, the Jewish people will be saved regardless, but you could do your job. And that then you'd be the one saving him, and that karma and your family would be cleared. So it's like, yeah, sure, the world will continue if you don't do your job, but it feels really good to do it.
It does. It feels very affirming to st that's the thing I don't think a lot of people get when we and I remember last week when I, or 2 weeks ago when I interviewed Rabbi YY Jacobson, he was talking about the same thing for 45 minutes. When we have the courage, the straight up chutzpah to say no, Yetzirah, no, asshole voice in my head. I'm not going to listen to you. I'm actually going to do what God put me on this planet to do. Having that level of courage, first of all, is terrifying, but being able to overcome it and go, no, I'm actually going to be myself. And the ones who mind don't matter, and the ones who matter don't mind. Not only does it feel good, obviously, but there's this sense of calm and peace, and there's no more pretending, and there's no more posturing, and there's no more, you know, putting on this front. People don't get that. Like, they've become so accustomed to just wearing this mask all the time. It's kind of sad, actually. And so, you know, I love that you're embodying it in what you do.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Now, in terms of you, I want to pick your brain. What is something Jewish, whether it's a Jewish tradition or one of our values or some experience maybe that you've had in your life that has held really deep meaning for you, that you would share with folks? And why was it deeply meaningful?
So there's two. One is kosher and the other is Shabbat.
Okay. All right. Hit me.
Okay. So kosher is pretty straightforward. I mean, well, I guess to me.
To you. Yeah. To me, no. It took me several years to just feel like I wasn't screwing up all the time.
So, I mean, you are what you eat. Health-wise, like if you're eating for your highest self, then you're eating what's healthy, what was raised healthy, what has that energy sort of all the way through, and embodying it. And it makes up who you are. It's also how you take care of the planet, too, which, again, you're part of. So from dust you were formed, from dust you will return, you are what you eat, all that stuff. But when you're talking about not eating a kid in its mother's or milk, like not mixing meat and milk, if you've ever heard the cry of a mother goat losing its kid, it's heart-wrenching.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why would you do that? Don't take the chicken who's broody and take all her eggs away. You know, it's not nice.
Yeah, it's
when
cruel.
When you kill an animal, do it as painless as possible if you have to. And most of the animals killed in ancient Judaism, we'll call it, were ceremonially killed.
Mm-hmm.
And with that came a huge amount of respect and care in how that was done. So that the animal was, like, I mean, they used to decorate the animals, walking them in parade down for Shavuot. Like, it was respectful. It wasn't, you know, these hurt animals in small pens taking to scary locations, and people not caring about their job or the animals.
Right.
So kosher, and I honestly don't believe a lot of us actually truly keep kosher to the standards that the Torah wants today.
Oh, say more about that.
I think that when you eat an animal that was not raised humanely, there's a concept you can't get a mitzvah through an avera.
Oh, wow.
So if you've got an animal that's being traumatized and then you go to you know, bless it, a brach on it, are you trying to get a mitzvah through an avera? So I think that a lot of we need to work harder on that as a people, and also the spirit of the law too. The spirit of the law wasn't just have a rabbi say a bracha and take a knife to it. The spirit of the law was what? Humanity to the animal,
right?
Being kind to God's creations.
Yeah, from the moment it was born. Yeah.
There's a rabbi who ended up getting sick because he looked at a lamb trying to get away from slaughter and said, well, this is what you were created for, versus having compassion. So it's like, to me, like, if people took kashrus as seriously as the Torah wanted, and the connection to the earth is serious, which connects us to the earth as seriously as it should, then we would be in a much better place around the world. The amount of Kalayim violations throughout the world, we have so little food stability thanks to that. And the amount of Jewish people involved in saying, hey, I shouldn't be eating this, and we shouldn't be growing this, and we should like take care of the earth better. Where are they?
So, can you say a little bit more about what that means in terms of like the English translation and what that looks like?
So Kalayim is mixing of two things. The
Okay.
idea is, so they do things like spicy mustard and mustard, or almonds and peaches, things that can cross,
Oh, for you
don't mix
mean like
them.
cross-pollination?
Cross-pollination, where the genetics get kind of mixed up, and then you end up with things that you don't quite know what it's going to be, and it's not really something you want to keep around. But it also means like you shouldn't graft something that is a like a citrus bottom that has no sweet fruit to a citrus top that has sweet fruit. You're not breeding out something strong. It's just weak. And it's one of the reasons most of the citrus in the world has to be sprayed with pesticides.
Right.
Or, we're running out of bananas, all those things. If you have apples and crab apples, don't mix them. How many apple trees out there are Kalayim? How many apples do we eat per year? And try to make a bracha. We make brachas on Rosh Hashanah over apples off of trees that are Kalayim.
That's so interesting. So normally, like for me, when I was first getting started as a Baal Tshuva and learning what everything means and how it works and whatever, I was always thinking of like, in terms of mixing like wool and linen. But this mixing, we really are talking about mixing all kinds of things. And in particular here, you're referring to mixing species, grafting fruit trees, grafting foods. And that it violates Torah and that it's something we need to be more mindful of. That's really important. Do you find that there's any rabbis that really take what you're saying seriously, or do they kind of shake it off like, oh, well, it's the 21st century, like, too bad?
I haven't had a lot of conversations with rabbis. I found the majority of the time rabbis don't want to talk to a woman like me. So
So clearly you're doing something right.
they would have to be up for the conversation, and I don't look like the type of person that would know that, I guess. So, which is fine. I don't have to look like how they want me to look. That's on them.
But we're not supposed to judge. We're supposed to love our fellow. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. That's
Sure.
how it's supposed to go.
And there are definitely rabbis out there that I've had the opportunity to talk to a little bit. And some of the times I'm the one that just shies away from the conversation too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can't imagine you shying away from any conversation around sustainability or harvest or food or anything ever.
No, I could be shy. I was this very shy child, so
Fair enough. Fair
yeah,
enough.
and
So
I,
now you said the first was kosher and the second was Shabbat.
yes, so Shabbat. I mean, to me, you can't. I don't know how you can live without that one. I tell you, I'm just like, oh, I can't. You need a Shabbat. You need to be able to take your nervous system and slow it down, get some processing, connect to your higher brain a little bit better, just process and not just run around. It's also getting out of that slave mentality.
Ooh, yeah, say more about that.
When you're in Shabbat, you're saying, I am not working for anyone. I am, God said to rest. I get to sort of, quote unquote, do what I want, even though it's, quote unquote, what God wants. So for someone who wants you to just work and be a slave, that's what they're, you have no benefit to them on a day of rest, theoretically. I mean, you can justify now where you charge your brain being able to have that rest, but if you're looking at bottom lines, most CEOs would probably say, you know, you can come in on Saturday and Sunday. I'll call you then. It also, like, when I was first starting to garden, I was starting on a balcony in California, and I had my little lettuce crop, and it was Shabbat, and I was looking at my little garden, and here comes the slug walking through my lettuce.
Oh no.
If it was a weekday, I would have been like, heck no, you fly off the balcony. But it was Shabbat, so I had to sit there and I watched this little slug walk through my lettuce. And it did actually walk through it. It stopped at a spot that was the weakest of the what was growing there. It ate a little bit and then it moseyed on. And that ability on Shabbat to observe, which in permaculture actually observe before interacting is like a huge thing too, is you need to observe rather than just continually react. So Shabbat, I think, is a huge reevaluation, observation, reset that I think is huge to humans choosing the right direction in the world.
So, and for those folks who maybe don't keep Shabbat or don't keep Shabbat yet, we have this understanding, one of the 39 rules of things we're not supposed to do on Shabbat. Well, really, like no gardening of any sort because it's very, very close to farming and we're not supposed to farm. But in addition to that, we are not permitted to even kill a bug. And we're, you know, if we were to pick up a slug and on the possibility that we would fling it and it would accidentally die, that would be considered an avera. It would be breaking Shabbat. And I can't count the number of mosquitoes and flies I've had to let slide. And like, I will go to another room because I have to not do that. But you're absolutely right. That level of intentionality and awareness, just it's unparalleled. I've actually had friends who are not Jewish who, you know, I tell them what I do on Shabbat. They're like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. Like, why doesn't everyone do that? I'm like, I don't know. Why doesn't everyone do that? It's a thing you can do. No one's stopping you.
It's hard when you first start it. It's like, oh, I can't turn on the electronics. I can't doom scroll. I have to not answer my phone for a whole day. I can't spend my day cooking because I've that would be cooking. I can do some food prep, but most of it, what do I do? What do I do today?
Yeah, exactly.
You
And
have
we're
to
so busy
actually.
doing, we forget to just be. I am super guilty of this. I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna say I've never checked my phone on Shabbat. I'm especially right after the war, I was very guilty of that. But yeah, it's that again, that's the beauty of that's the insanity of the fractal nature of Torah and Halacha. Like, how did they know 3,000 years ago that I was going to be tempted to look at my cell phone on Shabbat and ask about the war and talk about soldiers and all of this? And I'm not supposed to. I'm not supposed to think about it. I'm supposed to rest. Like, how did they know? It's wild. It's wild. So, in a final question, I would love to hear from you. If you could share one insight or a piece of wisdom with the Jewish world, a takeaway that has been really meaningful to you, what would that be?
I mean, think basically similar what I said before was, as Jews, We need to remember the Torah is for this world, and we are supposed to interact and be part of this world. And that means taking care of this world. This is a how to live here on earth. Torah is the book of life. What's true, it says in the first Tehillim, that which is false will blow away, that which is true will continue to stand. So if we're not living in a way that's sustainable, we are living in fallacy. We are not connecting with God. In order to connect with God, you need to live sustainably. You need to live in regeneratively. You need to give to the earth as much as you take.
In order to stay connected to God, you have to live sustainably and you have to give as much as you take. So this is. I mean, for me, obviously, it's not revolutionary. I hear this all the time. I know this. I've lived this. I used to teach this at Sonoma State. But for maybe some Jews out there who are listening, this might be revolutionary for them. If you, I know this is kind of kind of like unconventional, straying from my five questions. But could you give me like your top five? What are top five that an average from Jew or a Jew who's never kept a mitzvah in their life, what are five sustainable things that they could do that are fairly low-hanging fruit, pun intended, that they could do that could get them started down the road of connecting to Hashem through sustainable living?
The five low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, the five pawpaw or the five peaches or whatever we're going to pick. Yeah.
I would say you need to start learning about these things, because I think that's the first step is an awareness. And what Kabbalah, you go from thought to words to doing. So we need to start getting those thoughts into the community. We need to be like, hey, this is important, and this is things you can do, and this is this. There's so many different ideas available, and not everybody has to do the same thing. Not everybody's first physical step is going to be the same. But starting to learn, like, how do nutrients cycle? How much potassium is being mined? What do those mines look like? What does it look like ecologically? Or, what did this place look like before it was destroyed? What does where did that how did that animal feel that I'm eating right now? What did it look like when it was alive? Did it have a happy life? All these questions, which are great things to do on Shabbat, is to, as you're sitting at the table, you can go, deep diving into what your food is, having that consciousness as you're eating. So I think that would be a great first step. I don't know if that would be a that I don't know about top five.
Valid, valid. I think that this is a very critical conversation. I think this is a long-reaching conversation. I actually want to have you back for
Oh,
another
thank you.
episode. I think I want to do a part two where we dive into the meat and potatoes, pardon the pun, in terms of getting folks more equipped to ask these questions and to answer these questions. Like the average, Joe Schmo who goes to the kosher grocery store, directing their attention to this thing or that thing, and maybe arming them with some articles or some questions to ask or labels to look at or something to start shifting that dial towards I am connected to Hashem through this world, through this earth, and slowly feeding myself in a respectful, dignified way that aligns with balance. I feel like this is very relevant. So I'm gonna tell my listeners to stay tuned because I feel like I want to keep going with this. But this is all the time we have now for part one. So I have to thank you again, Amitshuk. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you. Thank
joining us.
you.
If anyone has any questions or would like to reach out to Amit and get to know her incredible organization, Imitating Eden, the show notes are going to have her website, her links, her contact information. And please feel free to reach out to me if you have further questions or if you know someone I should interview for How Do You Jew? Thank you so much, everyone, and have an incredible day. Let's love our fellow like we love ourselves, and let's get Geula already.